Next up, we'll have ergot control with Jeremiah Dung. He's an assistant professor in plant pathology at OSU at the Central Oregon Ag Research Center in Madras. His research focuses on epidemiology and management of plant diseases impacting the production of vegetable seed and specialty crops in Central Oregon, including cool season grasses grown for seed. Jeremiah?
Well, thanks everybody for staying through the end of the meeting today. I apologize in advance for my voice. I normally don't bring a cup of tea with me when I talk, but I might sip on that as I go through this presentation today. Before I begin, I'd like to acknowledge the other researchers that have contributed to this project over the last four years. One of those people is Darren Walenta there, sitting in the front there. He does a lot of the field work in the La Grande area with our growers. But as you'll see, we have Navni Kaur highlighted. She's in the lower left of that picture. She's been the postdoc on this project since 2014 and has really contributed a lot of data and a lot of understanding to this disease. So with that, I'll just get started. Ergot is an ancient disease of grasses. It's caused by a fungus called Claviceps purpurea, and really it's a seed replacement disease, and that's why we work on it in grass grown for seed. The fungus will infect unfertilized flowers, and those flowers, once they're infected, instead of producing a seed, they produce what we call a sclerotium, or plural is sclerotia. Those are also can be called ergots or ergot bodies. Now these sclerotia are the overwintering structures of the pathogen. And so those kind of serve as the seed of the fungus. It overwinters and then it produces spores the next spring. Now the problem with these ergot sclerotia is that they also contain toxic alkaloids. And these alkaloids can cause a lot of health problems, not only for humans, but also for other mammals that ingest them in feed or hay. In the past, in the Middle Ages, it could have been a major problem for humans, and it caused a disease called ergotism or St. Anthony's fire. You might read about that in some historical books. But today, it's primarily an issue in livestock, and we've, from what I hear, we do still see clinical cases of ergotism in livestock that have been fed ergot-contaminated feed. Now, for the grower and the seed cleaner, there's economic losses that are entailed at multiple levels. Being a seed replacement disease, obviously it will reduce yield because you're getting fewer seed and more ergot sclerotia. Causes a real headache for the seed cleaners because these ergot sclerotia are oftentimes very similar in size to the seed, and so it can make screening or cleaning these ergot sclerotia from the good seed very difficult. And so when seed lots are heavily contaminated and they have to be cleaned over and over again, a lot of good seed is lost. Now there's also economic losses due to fungicide applications, rejection of seed lot certification, and then some of the byproducts of the seed cleaning process like pellets or seed screenings, if they're too contaminated with ergot, they can't be used as feed for livestock. Now this is kind of a busy slide, but it's emphasizes the fact that the disease cycle of ergot is very complicated. And it starts with these ergot sclerotia. Those are the overwintering structures. In the spring, they'll germinate and they'll produce these tiny mushrooms. That's what those are. Those are usually less than an inch tall. And each of these tiny mushrooms can produce thousands and thousands of spores, and these ascospores are disseminated in the air by wind. And we think that they can travel very long distances. Now, when those ascospores land on an unfertilized flower, it'll infect that flower. After about a week or so, the first signs of infection is when the infected flowers start to produce a substance called honeydew. And that honeydew is just a mixture of plant sap and asexual spores that we call conidia. So there's two spore types. These are the airborne ascospores, and then we have conidia. and these conidia can be moved from plant to plant, either just by touching, through water, splashing, or even by insects. So there's this primary infection cycle with wind-borne ascospores, and then the secondary disease cycle that involves conidia. And then so after the plant is infected, the plant will produce these sclerotia, and that disease cycle is completed until the following year. Now, given the very complex disease cycle of ergot, we feel that a multi-tactic approach is necessary for the long-term management of ergot. So not just one management practice is really going to solve an ergot issue if you have it. First of all, using the cleanest seed possible, using seed that does not have any ergot sclerotia in it, is your first step to planting a clean field. Crop rotation can also be effective because these sclerotia are only thought to survive for about a year in field soils. So if you can rotate out of a grass crop for a year, that should reduce the amount of sclerotia that are in the field overwintering for your following crop. Now, Claviceps purpurea has a very wide host range among grasses, over 400 known hosts in the grasses. And so controlling your grassy volunteers, grassy weeds, and any other weedy hosts that might be occurring either in your field or even outside of your field can help reduce the amount of inoculum that's being produced. I'll talk a little bit about the sheer number of sclerotia that can be deposited in fields after harvest. So removing sclerotia during harvest can also help. That's a form of sanitation in removing the primary inoculum source. Resistant cultivars is another aspect of research that I'm not going to talk about today, but we've been looking at. And I'll also talk a lot about fungicides, protective fungicides applied both during anthesis and then also some of the experimental work that we're doing. Now, since the only unfertilized flowers are susceptible to infection, the timing of your fungicide applications is really important. These fungicide applications are protective, they're not curative, and so either that first application and any subsequent applications, the timing is very important in order to have the most success. And in some areas where ergot is endemic, a regional approach towards managing the disease might be necessary. And I just wanted to briefly show this slide. This was some intensive survey work that I did back in 2012, 2013. And it's just a heat map showing ergot intensity in a perennial ryegrass field. This is a first year field. The brighter colors indicate more ergot. And as you can see, we have much more ergot on the side of that new field where we had second and third year ryegrass fields that already had ergot. So we think what happened is these airborne ascospores or maybe even conidia were moving in from these older fields. And so that's where this regional approach is often necessary. You can't just focus on what's going on in your field, but also maybe what's going on in other ryegrass fields that are nearby. Now, I listed off quite a few management approaches that can be taken to help control ergot. A couple years ago, we did a survey of grassy growers in Oregon and Washington just to find out what are they doing to manage ergot on their farm. And as you can see, we had about a response rate of about 20, 23 growers and stakeholders. But as you can see, a lot of them are doing multiple things. You know, they're planting clean seed. They're doing crop rotation when they can. Some of them are burning in areas where that's an option. But as you can see, fungicide applications by far are the most common management tactic. And on average, we see that growers are applying about 2.2 sprays per season just to manage ergot. And so the timing of those 2.2 applications is very important. Kind of touched on this a few times. Well, why is timing important? Well, these are some data that was collected by Darren and others back in the early 2000s. And these bars are showing the occurrence of airborne ascospores in fields. And as you can see, they can start at a different time each year. So that can be very variable. And then also, if we start to look at when pollen is being produced or when these crops are starting to flower, it's not always a perfect overlap, but in many cases, by the time these grass seed crops are starting to flower, inoculum is already present. And so having your fungicide application occur right before that flowering starts is important to protect those first flowers against any inoculum that might already be available. So I just wanted to touch upon a disclaimer here. I am going to talk about first labeled products for grass grown for seed. We only have three. So that's why I'm also going to start talking about some of the experimental products that we're looking at, things that are not labeled, things that we might be applying in an unlabeled fashion under a research and demonstration pesticide license. So the first product that's labeled for grass grown for seed to control ergot is propiconazole or Tilt. This is a group 3 fungicide, very effective. There are some specific use restrictions, especially in regards to if you want to cut the hay and feed that after you harvest your grass grown for seed, or if you want to graze. So it's important to take a look at these specific use restrictions afterwards, and then also how much of that product you can actually apply in a given season. The other product that's labeled for grass grown for seed to control ergot is azoxystrobin or Abound. This is a group 11 fungicide. Again, a lot of growers use this as well. That also has some restrictions on what you can do with these screenings after harvest. Now, I said that we have three products labeled to control ergot and grass grown for seed, but the third product that I'll talk about is really just a premix of the first two products, azoxystrobin and propiconazole. It's available as Quilt or Quilt XL. So really, we only have two chemistries available to control ergot in grass grown for seed, and that can be an issue when it comes to fungicide resistance management in the pathogen. So why do we care about fungicide resistance management? Well, the more times you apply the same chemistry to a population of a pathogen, the more likely you are to develop potential fungicide resistance and insensitivity, just like what can occur in weeds or insects. Now, whenever possible, it's recommended to rotate between FRAC groups or fungicide resistance action committee groups, and we only have the two, so rotation's a little hard if we're talking about managing ergot with more than two sprays per season. These FRAC-11 QOI inhibitors are particularly prone to potential fungicide resistance development. And so on the label, it specifies that, that these FRAC-11 fungicides should not constitute more than one-third of your total fungicide applications if you're using that alone. If you're using it with a tank mix, like with Quilt XL, or if you're mixing it with Tilt on your own, then that can constitute up to half of your fungicide applications in a given year on that crop. But let's remember, we also have to deal with powdery mildew, rust, and other diseases in maybe the same field. And so we have to keep that in mind. Any applications that you do using FRAC-11s to control powdery mildew or rust need to be accounted for when you're determining how many applications can I really make on this field. So our management, our research is looking at all kinds of approaches to manage ergot, ranging from cultural practices all the way up to chemical protection. And today I'll talk a little bit about some of the fungicide work that we're doing, a little bit about some of the biological control options that we're investigating, and then I'll stop with some of the disease models that we've been developing. So this was a trial that Navneet conducted this last year, looking at four potentially new products. This is a trial to look at fungicide applications during flowering to protect the flowers from primary inoculum, or those ascospores. And so we had a non-treated control, and we were also comparing it against a Quilt XL industry standard. And you can see we were really trying to look at some new frac groups. So we included some frac 7 chemistries as well as some premixes that include both frac 3 and 7 or frac 11 and 7. And as you can see, these two tank mixes performed reasonably well, although a product C wasn't significantly different from the control. It did knock the incidence of ergot back by about half, and the severity as well. Product D was also significantly different from the control. And what was interesting is this was the second year that we did the trial, and last year all four products were significantly different or better than the non-treated control. So we're going to be conducting this study for a third year, and we'll see what kind of results we get in year three. Now, just remember product C in this slide. So that's some of the work that we were doing to protect flowers. Now, I want to talk a little bit about using these products in a different manner to try to reduce sclerotial germination in the field. So these sclerotia can be deposited in the field after harvest. And what's amazing is Darren and I spent several days sweeping fields after harvest. And essentially what we found were a lot of sclerotia. These data are showing 3 fields over 2 years. And these numbers are number of sclerotia per meter squared. And I know that doesn't mean anything to you, but if we were to convert this high number of about 119 sclerotia per meter squared that we found in that 1 year, that equates to over 480,000 sclerotia per acre. So there's a potentially large number of sclerotia that are being deposited in these fields after harvest. And you can see in each field we saw a jump from the first year to the second year. So what we wanted to know was, well, can we apply fungicides to the soil, maybe in the fall or in the spring, and try to knock back sclerotial survival and germination? Well, we've been doing this work for about 4 years in the field now, and so far product C, which was also effective during anthesis, has consistently performed the best over the last 4 years. Now, it's not always statistically different, but numerically we see reductions from anywhere from about 40 to over 70% sclerotial germination in the spring. And so what we have here is an area under capitula production curve, which is basically a number representing sclerotial germination. That's the red on the y-axis. The x-axis are all the products. The red bars are non-treated control. And as you can see, product F, C, E, those were all very effective this year. And the colors of the bars represent when we made the application. So white bars indicate a spring application, gray bars indicate a fall application, and black bars indicate applications that were made both in the spring and the fall. And you can see a lot of the gray and the black bars tend to be on the left side of that figure, and that's also been consistent from year to year. So we think that maybe these fall applications are the ones that we should be targeting for potential future labels. Just one slide on the biological control options that we're looking at. We looked at 4 products this year. They were already labeled for other diseases and other crops. 3 of them were fungal products. 1 of them was a bacterial product. And this is these are data that were collected in the lab, so not in the field. But you know, in the lab, we saw that at least 3 of these products significantly reduced sclerotia germination in the lab. And so we're going to conduct this study on small field plots on the station this year. Now, I mentioned before that only unfertilized flowers are susceptible to infection, and so the timing of those fungicide applications are really important. Now, the timing of flowering can vary from cultivar to cultivar and from year to year, and the timing of spore production can vary from year to year and from location to location. So what we wanted to do was develop a predictive model to try to provide a decision aid for growers that they can use to help determine when the risk for ergot infection would be the highest, and maybe they can use that information to better time their fungicide applications. We did this by combining spore trapping, using these spore traps in commercial fields, as well as artificially infested plots, and we just used the AgriMet weather station that was nearby. So all of the predictive models data that I'll be presenting today was developed in the Columbia Basin. I just wanted to keep that, everybody keep that in mind, for the Willamette Valley growers. This was all work done in the basin. So what we did is we collected a slew of data from these weather stations, and then we collected spore trapping data from multiple fields over a period of 3 years. And what we looked at for were these upper and lower thresholds of these data that accounted for the most amount of spores. And what was really interesting was that when we looked at the minimum air and the maximum air temperature that was most closely associated with ergot spore production in the field, these numbers were very, very close to what others have found in growth chamber studies. So this was a positive sign. Real world data supporting what's been found in the lab by others. So we use these upper and lower thresholds to develop a degree day model with a base temperature of 50 degrees Fahrenheit and an upper threshold temperature of 77 degrees Fahrenheit. We ran that cumulative degree day model, and then again we looked at the lower and the upper threshold of these data on days when spores were present. And so when the degree day, cumulative degree days were between 414 and 727, we'll say, between that period, that's when we saw 94% of the total spores for that season. So what that's telling us is that if we can target our fungicide applications to cover that degree day window, we're going to protect our crop from over 90% of the spores that occurred. So what does that look like over a period of the last 15 or 16 years? This is the mean cumulative air degree day accumulation from 2000 to 2016. And the solid arrow going down is that 414 number. And then the dotted line is that 727 number. So this is the window where we would expect to find the majority of spores present. And you can see that window is anywhere from about the 10th of May up until about the 1st of June. Well, let's start overlapping some of the data from the last 15 years or so. So 2000 to 2005, 2006 to 2010. Well, 2011 was kind of the coolest year in terms of degree day accumulation over the last 16 years, and you can see that this window has shifted quite a bit by almost 2 weeks or so. So this is that year-to-year difference. 2012 to 2014, well, let's see what happened in 2015. That was a pretty warm year. You can see that that degree day window shifted back by about a couple weeks. Now that arrow there is showing the first occurrence of spores, and you can see that the first occurrence of spores had occurred about between a week and 10 days before this window started. 2016, another warm year. Again, this window shifted a little bit more to the left. And again, the first spores were found or trapped about 7 to 10 days before this window. But again, this window is accounting for the majority of the spores, not all of them. So the critical periods in past seasons, if we were to look at historical references, anywhere from May 1st all the way down to June 15th could be the critical window. What's important, though, is that this window over the last 4 or 5 years has been a period of about 3 to 4 weeks. And so if we can time our fungicide applications to protect the plants for those 3 to 4 week period, I think that would really help in terms of managing ergot on a year-to-year basis. One last thing before I wrap up is some of the outreach that we're doing. Over the last couple years, we've produced what we call the Ergot Alert newsletter. It's delivered electronically via email. So far, we've only done it for the Columbia Basin, Central Oregon, and the Grand Ronde Valley, because that's where Ergot has been most severe, and over the last few years anyway. And so what this does is we provide weekly updates on our spore trapping. We also provide crop phenology data for different cultivars of bluegrass and ryegrass. And we try to provide some timely management recommendations at the same time. We anticipate to include this degree day model in some of the newsletters. And we also have some new technologies that we're going to be trying out this year to help reduce the turnaround time between data collection and data reporting. I think I might be out of time. If anybody would like to come up and chat afterwards, feel free. I'll be around for the rest of the meeting. I do want to acknowledge our funding sources, especially the Oregon Seed Council, various other funding sources, and couldn't do the work without the support of the industry and the growers as well. Thank you.